Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, as you know, we just talked with our TV colleagues, Mike and myself. Day two of Fed Chair Jay Powell up on Capitol Hill. What we got today, par for the course. Powell stressing that policymakers had not made up their minds on the size of their interest rate increase later this month and said it would hinge on incoming data on jobs and inflation. Mike, it sounds like data dependent to me.
It really does. And what's fascinating is that's as honest as they can be about the situation, right?
Right.
And they repeat it over and over again.
Transparency with a capital T.
Yeah. But the market just wants that sort of certainty of where they are going to stop raising rates, and they just can't tell you right now. And I think, you know, if the story of the market over the last year is not up, down, it's sideways. You know, you look at the S&P's average over the last year, it's basically where we are now. So all this volatility, all these up, downs, days and downs, the market really hasn't gone anywhere.
All right, let's see what our former Bloomberg colleague, Yelena Shalechieva, senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, has to say about all of this. She joins us via Zoom in New York City. Yelena, it's so good to have you here with Mike and myself. All right, so we got Jay Powell day two. You got the Beige Book. You got another strong bunch of data points when it comes to the labor market. What was front and center for you today?
I think you highlighted it, Carol, and it's so nice to be back with you guys. So you highlighted it very clearly. You know, the Fed is data dependent, but, you know, Powell saw the market reaction to his testimony yesterday, and he decided to repeat the same exact hawkish message today. And, you know, he qualified it a little bit that, well, yeah, it's data dependent. He wanted to stress that point. That was the only kind of caveat in today's remarks. But still, the tone of the speech today was the same hawkish type of comments that he delivered yesterday. And I think it would be very difficult for the Fed to walk back from away from that hawkish message. It would take a really weak economic data for them to underdeliver on what he seemed to have hinted in his prepared remarks.
You know, and Yelena, obviously we're all biting our nails waiting for that main event of economic data on Friday, the jobs report. ADP's jobs report today, 242,000 private sector jobs. That JOLTS job openings was a little bit higher than expected, 10.8 million openings. Are you bracing for another hot jobs number?
So that totality in Powell's words of employment data is telling us that the labor market remains extremely tight. And there's no question about it, whether you look at like some movements, some near-term movements in job openings or claims or anything else, ADP. So all of it is telling us the same exact story. The labor market remains tight. And that is ahead of the payrolls report on Friday. So we are expecting another solid reading. We're slightly above consensus here at 240. So we think we will see some reversal of weather-related distortions that were very prominent in the January report. We estimate something like 30% of the number was driven by weather-related distortions. But still, you know, February was still warm. I was like not wearing my warm clothes.
It's crazy, right? The birds are singing, the plants are coming up.
Right.
Yelena, can I ask you something? Is totality now the new transitory that we're going to parse over exactly what this new T word means?
Another T word, right, Carol?
Yeah.
So it does seem like that. They keep repeating that sentence, but that's what it is. So they look at a whole bunch of different indicators, including wage growth. So that's another key story in the upcoming payrolls report on Friday. We will. We are looking for some reacceleration of wage growth in the payrolls report in February. So if that comes to fruition, we may, you know, that is going to be a very interesting story for the Fed, because Chair Powell specifically mentioned wages and wage growth in his testimony. It was right in the first few paragraphs that wage growth is great for workers, but when you know you look at it in terms of inflation and nominal wages, that could be a different story. So we don't want a significant reacceleration in nominal wages, and this is something that we may see on Friday. So that's gonna that if it is true, that would be another piece of a puzzle to persuade the Fed that they need to potentially go faster and stay in the restrictive territory for longer.
You know, Yelena, I think one of the big sort of underappreciated issues for the market this year is everyone talks about, well, how high will the Fed increase interest rates? But the markets previously were pricing in sort of a short-term peak, and that the Fed would probably be cutting rates this year. Now it seems like everyone's rethinking that, and that, yeah, we might hit that peak rate, whether it's 5.5%, 6% for Fed funds interest rate, but it's going to stay there longer than what the market had anticipated before. Where do you stand on that? How long will we sit at that peak rate, do you think?
Our newly released projections, we just released a new global outlook just recently. So we don't see any cuts until next year. So it's really was the message from the Fed that they're very serious about staying there for longer. It's just that the market is adjusting to that, as you mentioned. So I think it would really depend on the pace of inflation deceleration. So it's really easy to get to something like 3 to 4% in terms of inflation growth, but the trajectory of disinflation from there and to the 2% inflation target is going to be very difficult to achieve, and it might take some time. And that's why the Fed is clearly telling us we're going to stay there until the job is done. We're going to stay at it and keep at it and do whatever it takes to conquer inflation, which may need to, for that, we may need to see rates higher for longer.
So, all right. So if that could possibly happen, and then Yelena, looking at what's going on between the twos and tens right now, right above the spread, more than 100 basis points, does that mean, yes, definitely recession? Does that also potentially mean recession deeper and longer?
Well, recession has been front and center of our outlook. We are sticking with our call, unfortunately, for a recession. And that we think is a necessary condition for inflation to come back at where it needs to be. So the path to so-called soft landing is so narrow that it would be a miracle if that realizes. We all want that, but the reality is it may take us through a downturn in order to achieve that.
But what kind of a downturn? That's what I'm curious about. Is it deeper?
Right.
Is
so,
it wider?
Yeah.
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, something akin to the 90s recession, probably not severe.
I remember that recession.
Yeah, well.
I was at work after that.
I remember the financial crisis recession, probably not as severe as that, but
okay.
Still, you know, severe enough for a lot of Americans to feel the pain. but unfortunately maybe a necessary condition for us to go back into balance.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that means grunge music will come back, Carol, if we're ready for that. But
anything's possible.
Elena, obviously the other big number on tap next week, CPI. I'm looking at the consensus estimate here for it to come down from 6.4% to 6%, core to come down from 5.6 to 5.4. Where do you stand on that? What's your marker for next week's CPI report?
So we think, you know, payrolls would be more crucial in terms of defining what the Fed does next. So CPI will probably decelerate. We will be looking at where services inflation is going. If that super core services inflation is sticking where it is, and we call it sticky inflation, for that to go down, we need to see wages to decelerate. If that is still significant, that will reinforce the Fed's message. You know, right. What really struck us in the previous CPI report is the breadth of inflation gains. It was everywhere in the goods, in the services, you know, categories.
Right.
So I would personally be looking at the breadth of inflation gains.
Yelena, really fast, 25 seconds. Okay, hot labor market. What if we get a strong jobs report, but weak CPI data? Can the Fed be softer in their March move? Just quickly.
What we need to see is significant significant deceleration in wage pressures. That's what we should be looking at. That's what is important.
Okay, good to know. Always great to see you. We love you. Yelena Shaletyeva, as we said, a former Bloomberg colleague, senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, joining us via Zoom in New York City.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Actually, been talking with a lot of well-known folks in the restaurant space: Eric LaPere, Danielle Ballou, John Tapper, Bar Rescue. One common denominator that they seem to all talk about and stress is the tight labor market and just having a hard time finding enough workers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of competition for jobs out there. Let's be honest, restaurants.
But it's restaurants.
Yeah, but they're not exactly known for their high wages and great benefits and stress-free atmosphere.
That is several good points. All right. So in keeping with that, and we did get a lot of labor points, if you will, economic statistics today. This next story definitely jumps out at us. It's about how restaurants have come roaring roaring back post-pandemic with everything they need but staff. So let's get to it with Bloomberg News consumer reporter Leslie Patton. She joins us. She's on the phone from Chicago. Leslie, good to have you here with Mike and myself. So we do hear this a lot. Tell us what you found out in reporting your story.
You know, it's interesting. We're seeing that demand is up. Everyone knows about there's this pent-up demand for dining happening. Teams are expanding quickly, looking to open new locations. But kind of the problem is staff. A lot of these people, and you know, what's different than in the past is that a lot of these food service employees have left the industry for good and did that over the course of the pandemic for a bunch of different reasons, really.
Leslie, I'm wondering, is it having an impact on their businesses? You know, are they missing out on sales because of this? Are they having to close locations, anything like that?
Yes, that's been happening during the pandemic, but 3 years later, it's still happening. And a lot of these big chains, they don't like to explicitly say, we're missing sales. But you can read between the lines. A lot of them, the big chains are still operating on reduced hours, so they're not open as long as they used to be during the pandemic. So maybe they aren't running that night shift. Maybe the dining room's closed during certain times of the day. Domino's has said they still can't find enough delivery drivers, so it's taking longer to get each pizza to people's doors. So yes, all of that affects sales.
I mean, how bad is it? Is it mom and pop? It sounds like you're telling us about some well-known names. So how bad is it across the industry?
It's harder for mom and pops, I think, overall, for the independents to find and keep workers in a lot of cases. But we're hearing it from big chains, too. I mean, Jack in the Box is still doing reduced hours. They're not open as much as they used to be. And all of this is happening, one important thing to keep in mind, despite pretty big gains for wages.
You know, it's funny. I'm thinking back, Leslie, to my own days working at Denny's as a teenager. And one thing I always looked forward to was that free meal you got on your shift is a nice perk at a restaurant. But I'm wondering, are there perks like that? I mean, obviously, probably a free meal is not enough to bring anyone back. But are these companies doing anything? Is there anything they can do or that they're trying to do to attract workers?
Yeah, I mean, I think pay benefits, those are the big ones, and they all are offering higher pay than they used to, and in a lot of cases, more benefits. One interesting thing I found talking to a Burger King and Qdoba franchisee, he's in West Virginia in Ohio, he said that he started doing an extra $2 an hour attendance bonus just to get people to show up for their shifts because he was having so many call-outs and no-shows. It definitely has helped, so when it comes down to it, it's the money, right?
Well, can you remind us, you know, in Mike's day, you know, he'd go work for a restaurant, right, or a franchise. I have a sister who worked at McDonald's, like, growing up. Like, these were jobs teenagers, you know, definitely sought out. What's the typical labor pool for restaurants that they typically pull from?
It is still somewhat of an entry-level job, but I think you're right. That idea as restaurants is your first job, as you go to the local McDonald's down the street and you get a job when you're 16, I think that idea has kind of dissipated in a lot of ways, right? So we're not seeing as many younger teenage workers. Maybe they have internships or they're doing more after school activities, that sort of thing. It's really the kind of millennial Gen X generation that's working in restaurants these days.
Can I just to follow though, what about immigrants? And, you know, and you know, that typically that's often an entry job for folks who come into this country. Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. You know, we saw fewer immigrants over the, you know, the past, what was it, 4 or 5 years or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, the meat industry has called that out too, because the meat industry, the packing and slaughtering houses, they employ so many immigrants, and they're really struggling for staff and were during the pandemic and during kind of the Trump presidency, and that's because of stricter border control.
You know, Leslie, I sometimes feel like a broken record, because I feel like every economic markets discussion always reverts back to the topic of inflation. And I'm wondering, you know, this all sounds to me like we should expect higher prices from restaurants going forward. Has there been a lot of price increases? I mean, I know there's been some, but what is sort of the vibe there as far as the outlook for higher prices at restaurants?
Great question. So there have been a lot of price increases for restaurants over the past year or so. But at the same time, I think we can probably expect more because wages are continuing to be pressured. There's still a shortage of staff, which means wages need to go up further, which means menu prices are going up further. This really doesn't give too much hope for the Fed's emphasis on kind of stemming inflation in that service sector. I mean, maybe the rate is coming down a little bit, but it certainly isn't over.
Yeah, it does feed into that wage inflation and makes it stickier. What do folks in the restaurant industry typically make? And what kind of, you know, increases have they been getting?
I think on average, you know, a fast food cook is maybe around $12 or $13. But a lot of states have this kind of, you know, $15 minimum wage. A lot of municipalities have moved to that. So it really varies across the country. I mean, still we're at this federal minimum wage of around $7. So there's huge, huge discrepancies across the country in terms of what people are making. You know, in here, I'm in Chicago. I've seen restaurants put signs up saying they're hiring people starting at $20 an hour. But that's certainly not the case in some more rural areas.
Well, 20 an hour. That's where I'm sending my kids, Carol, to those places.
It's not too shabby.
You know, let's see. I remember a few years ago, prior to the pandemic, some restaurants started trying to automate as much as the process as possible. That, you know, ordering with touch screens, that sort of thing. You know, there's even talk about, well, maybe, you know, the cooking and preparation of the food could be automated. Where do you see that going? Obviously there's a greater motivation to automate as much as possible now, but are we seeing that play out at all in real life?
It's going, it's happening, but it's slow going is the important thing to remember. And another thing, I mean, we're not going to have robots necessarily cooking all of our food in the next few years. I mean, these are still largely very much people labor jobs. I mean, we see kiosks in restaurants and fast food places sometimes, but when you think about it, when you go in, do you go to the kiosk or do you go to the register if there's someone standing there? I think 9 times out of 10, people go to the person. They don't go to the kiosk. So there's movement there, but it's slow and it's, you know, incremental at this point.
I got to say, at a Panera, I have no problem with using my app and then just running by and picking up or going in and using their kiosk and then you just pick it up. So I do wonder if at some point, Leslie, these restaurant chains are going to have to do more automation, especially if this trend doesn't change. I mean, it's not easy. It's long hours, sometimes not great hours and not great conditions, many would argue. And just got about 20 seconds here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, with the apps, I think, yes, that's a way to kind of like for restaurants to skip over these kiosks. And the pandemic has taught us to be more okay with ordering, you know, Grubhub, that sort of thing on an app. So yeah, I think that's right, Carol.
Right, you go to an airport, right? You just it's a iPad.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden somebody like brings you food.
I'm waiting for the ChatGPT element, Carol. You know, can you have
what should I eat?
Yeah, give me a new recipe for you know, something.
Cook it up before you get on the plane. Leslie Patton, great story, and really relevant. Leslie Patton, she's consumer reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Chicago.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek from Bloomberg Radio.
It is International Women's Day, and we thought it made a lot of sense to check out how the Impact Shares YMCA Women's Empowerment ETF was doing. The ETF celebrated its 3-year anniversary, Mike, that happened last August. It's up on average annually nearly 15% over the past 3 years. Top holdings, we're talking about names you know, NVIDIA, Amazon, Apple, Meta, J&J, and more. So let's get to it. With us is Jill O'Donovan, advisor to Impact Shares. She joins us via Zoom from Chicago. Jill, good to have you here with Mike and myself. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about the investment theory, this ETF, what it specifically can invest in. And it tracks an index, correct?
It does. It does. So the actual gender equity research is done by Equileaf out of the Netherlands. And that information is taken and given to Morningstar, who creates the Women's Empowerment Index. And then the fund is developed based on that index. And the work of the YWCA in relation to this is as the impact partner. The YWCA, as many people tend to not know, has been around for over 160 years, empowering women and working to eliminate racism throughout the United States. And because our focus is women's empowerment, we thought this was a great partnership. We provide a lot of the advice about what things do empower women in the workforce, and looking at specifically the Equileap criteria and the way that those specific things really align with the work that we've been doing for all these years.
So what are some of the things that are screened for? I'm assuming representation of women on boards and C-suites, that sort of thing, Jill?
Yes, that's one of the first tiers that we look at. There's four broad categories of the 19 criteria, the first being gender balance and leadership in the workforce. Then we also consider equal compensation and work-life balance as a category, policies promoting gender equity, and then a general overall commitment to women's empowerment and the transparency of the company and accountability. So within each of those four, there are some sub-sectors. Obviously, women on boards, which is a big topic right now, and as well as women in the C-suite. But we dive a little bit deeper and also look at women in senior management, the overall workforce. We look at the promotion and career development opportunities by comparing the senior management and workforce, and look at what companies are doing in those areas to really be able to advance women throughout their company, not just at the top levels.
Hey, Jill, do you feel like it's transparent in terms of, I mean, some of those are pretty obvious, right? You can look at a board and understand how many women are there. But when you start talking about career development policies and so on, how do you really get a good grasp of what's going on in a company? They can say they're doing one thing, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're doing it.
Right, right. On a high level, we rely on the research that Equileap is doing. But then when the YWCA gets involved, we have a lot of interactions with some of these companies just based on the fact that they're corporate donors or corporate sponsors, just to individual YWCAs across the country. And so we get to know the folks that work at these companies, and we can help sort of guide them along the way on their journey for these, to better themselves in these different areas.
And they're receptive?
So far, it's been a slow process, and we are a nonprofit, so our resources are fairly limited when it comes to devoting a lot of energy to really engage with the corporations. But we're building on that. One of the things we like to say is we do a lot of work on the ground level preparing women for the marketplace, and we really see that there's an opportunity to prepare the marketplace for these women. And so we're shifting in that direction to, try to really use all levers that are available to us to advance the work that we're doing.
Jill, there's been a bit of a backlash recently from some very far right politicians about investing notions such as ESG and corporate programs for diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm wondering if that's on your radar screen at all. Is it a risk for an ETF like this, say, if some state's pension fund will be forbidden from investing in this type of vehicle? How are you thinking about that backlash?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a concern. We like to think of ourselves as the true S in ESG. I mean, we are the social experts in these areas. We know what it takes to make these changes, to advance women in the workplace. So we like to distinguish ourselves that way, that it's not just, it's not just sort of a greenwashing or a women washing. This is something that we bring these two worlds together, we can make real change.
It is interesting because I do feel like, Jill, that we kind of are having these conversations over and over again. My team knows, because every time we're talking about this subject, I feel like when I kicked off my career a few years ago, many years ago, we were having these conversations about women and equity and gender balances. As you see it and as you are having the conversations with companies and, working with the folks that are doing research on equity and gender equity, are we making progress?
We are. It's slow. We didn't get to this place overnight. We're not going to fix it overnight. It's a long road. And that's why, after as we've been doing this work for over 160 years, you know, really looking at ways to use all of the resources that are available to us. You know, we see this as a very important impact tool, or a very important platform for us to be able to change the conversation, be in different rooms, you know, really talk to people, get them thinking about, as an employee, what can you be asking of your employer? As a company, what can you be doing differently? As an investor, how can you be directing your funds to, you know, companies that are doing the things you want them to do? And also for just general consumers, you know, making them aware of these things and how they can use their money to actually drive the work that we're trying to do.
Jill, I wonder, is there any potential to be sort of an activist shareholder with this type of fund, you know, voting against firms, proxy, in proxy votes, you know, against policies that you're not happy with at a company? You know, is there any chance of that?
Absolutely. And that, you know, that's one of the long term goals that we have, you know, to be able to be more activist investors. As far as the shareholder proxy issues or the shareholder resolutions are concerned, recently Impact Shares filed a shareholder resolution with Norfolk Southern about paid sick leave. And just, I believe it was last week, and that was based on the holdings that they have in the Women Fund. And I believe last week, Norfolk Southern reported that they had negotiated with two unions, and this was in direct response to the shareholder proposal that Impact Shares had filed.
Hey, Jill, I'm just gonna I'm just gonna push a little bit, but your ETF, the Women's Empowerment ETF. If I look at some of the top holdings: Nvidia, Amazon, Apple, Exxon, United Health, Meta, J&J, Procter & Gamble, Comcast. All of them have men CEOs. So mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying in terms of progress, but I just feel like, you know, what is the conversation you're hearing about why we're not seeing more female CEOs?
That's a very good question. You know, there was a time when the reason was, well, there just aren't any, or, you know, they're just not quality candidates. I think that conversation has changed. I think it's one of those things that will just take time, and to be able to, you know, have it's one of the reasons, in fact, that we look at sort of this overall promotion and career development track, so that we have that sort of that pool to be mm-hmm. creating and pulling from. It is slow. It's very slow progress. And, you know, with respect to the companies that are in the index, I know that there's, you know, people can come up with issues for each of the different companies that, you know, don't tick different boxes. And we would love to see a time where each of the holdings actually, you know, they're getting A grades across the board from Equileap on these different categories. Equileap just released their most recent mm-hmm. report, and it looks like, you know, even the best companies are still in the C+ category. So, you know, it's going to take more time, but I think we are, you know, we're encouraged. We see a shift in at least the last 5 years. Well, I think it's been a lot bigger.
That's a good thing. I'm going to have to leave it on that note. Jill, thank you so much. Jill O'Donovan, advisor of Impact Shares, joining us via Zoom from Chicago.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
No doubt about it. Everybody's talking about it, jumping in. Just yesterday, Salesforce's VC arm launched a $250 million fund, its largest to date, to invest in generative artificial intelligence startups. Bloomberg talked with Ken Griffin of Citadel. We talked about this too, how they are negotiating an enterprise-wide license to use OpenAI's ChatGPT tool. I mean, everybody, it's everywhere.
It's amazing. And I mean, you know what, there's been hype around AI for years, but it's just really reached this crescendo. You know, it kind of reminds me of when companies would just started adding blockchain to the name of their company to get
a boost for stock or dot com.
So it's hard not to imagine that maybe people get a little carried away with this.
All right. So we want to talk about this. We want to talk about VC more broadly. We've got a perfect guest, Alison Baumgate. She's general partner at Semper Virens, where she invests in technology transforming companies in work health and financial wellness. She is with us via Zoom in San Francisco. She's got a book out, Breaking Into Venture, an outsider turned venture capitalist, shares how to take risks, create power, and build life-changing wealth. Alison, welcome, welcome. Nice to have you here with us. First of all, if we can start broadly, what is the environment today for investing in startups? Is it a good one?
Today is actually the best time in recent history to invest in startups. The venture capital industry has gone through a lot of changes over the last several decades, but the best businesses tend to be built in recessions. And not that we're technically in a recession, but when you see a pullback, and it's a lot easier to determine which companies are actually building real value as opposed to just increasing their valuation because there are a lot of investors around the table. And these are the times when it's easier to find that signal from the noise.
You know, Alison, it seems like a year or two ago, there was so much buzz towards crypto and Web3 in the VC space. How's the vibe there for that now? Is it, you know, is that all sort of gone away? Is there any funding being done for crypto and Web3 businesses these days?
It's definitely cooled off significantly. And we've seen a lot of the excitement and the hype cycle around crypto and Web3 now move toward AI and generative AI, per your point earlier. But what I think it's what's really important for investors and entrepreneurs to understand, and is the reason why I wrote this book, is that venture capital is an industry that has hype cycle after hype cycle. And that is inevitable. And so being able to understand how to navigate some of that excitement and put it in context for yourself when you're deciding whether to take a job at a technology company, whether to invest in a technology company, whether to start one. You have to be able to sift through that and understand how the industry works if you're going to figure out what to actually pay attention to.
Let's go there. You said, you know, to figure out what's hype and what's not. What is hype in this environment? What's not? AI, not hype.
I think everybody in venture agrees that AI is incredibly exciting. As you said, it's been around for a long time, but we've clearly crossed a threshold very recently where it can start to have some more exciting commercial applications. But again, the mission of this book is to try to open up the venture capital industry, make it apparent how it operates, what incentives are at stake, so that we can bring more types of people around the table. We're at a moment in time right now with AI where the business model behind some of its applications is going to determine who it affects, how it affects them, how it grows and changes over time. And it's going to be affecting us for generations. And we need more types of perspectives, more types of people around the table talking about what business model makes the most sense, because it is the venture investors behind some of these companies that determine what the business models are. And that has implications for society more broadly. So I think it's important that society is reflected in venture capital funds as well.
Are you saying to be fair, right, AI's been out there for a while, but we're taking mm-hmm. it to another level. Is it fair to say that we really don't know exactly how it's going to impact this, and we're all kind of in this giant lab right now?
Absolutely. That's the exciting thing about disruption, is you just don't know exactly where it's going to go. But that's where the diversity of perspectives is really critical.
You know, and Allison, the other obvious buzzworthy thing in VC was medical healthcare type of spaces after the pandemic. Is that where does mm-hmm. that stand now? Is there still a lot of buzz or hype around, startups dealing with sort of COVID or the next virus that we have to worry about type of situation?
We invest in digital healthcare, and COVID created a variety of catalysts for adoption of new technology in the space. When we evaluate a business, we look at 5 T's in our diligence process. We look at technology, team, terms, TAM, and most importantly, timing. And there are a lot of great ideas that just have the wrong timing. But COVID, I think, unlocked a lot of reimbursement models, made it possible to do virtual care, which has changed a lot of the landscape around healthcare. So I think we're still really excited about how that has disrupted the industry for the better. But there are a lot of businesses that thought they had product market fit, but they actually had COVID market fit. And I think some of those are getting sorted out from the group now.
You know,
that makes sense.
It's interesting. I'm thinking if folks are listening to you, right? And there's a lot of folks who come out with MBAs and they don't necessarily go to Wall Street anymore. If they do, it's kind of a touch and go. And then they go out to the venture capital world, right? And I, certainly think about your own experience, right? You were at Goldman and, here you are. But what I'm wondering is, when you think about companies who are buying, maybe it's older line companies, like I'm thinking about a Weight Watchers, right, that bought a telehealth provider yesterday. We saw the mm-hmm. stock soar on the news. Like, what is your advice to folks who are looking at kind of trying to figure out where to go? Is this an old line company, but they're doing some cool things that are innovative. So what's your advice on that?
That's a lot of what we cover in the book. And of course, on its cover, it's geared toward anyone that wants to break into venture capital. But the concepts actually apply to any kind of career and figuring out where you want to place your bets, right? If you take a job at a company, you're actually investing your time and your reputation with that company as well. So it is very similar to the venture model in that way. And a lot of what I encourage individuals to do, whether you're an entrepreneur, a professional, or a venture capitalist, is to do your homework and understand what exactly you're joining, what that looks like, and then what it means for you in the future. Does it open up more possibilities, or will it shut off possibilities for you? So my advice is to surround yourself with people that can help you figure out what makes most sense and what's going on behind the curtain, because everybody knows how to tell a great story. But what really matters is who's pulling the strings and what kind of power they have and what that means for you.
Allison, obviously the markets this year have been so laser focused on these surging interest rates. I'm wondering, does that have a chilling effect on early stage VC or not? There's just so much dry powder that it doesn't really matter.
Absolutely, it has an impact. We're investing in growth businesses, right? And the cost of capital is a really big factor in how quickly companies can grow and how they're valued. And I think the current environment, the compression in multiples in the public markets is going to have the biggest impact on later stage companies that have raised a lot of capital already and have raised at valuations that were based on assumed revenue rates that they hadn't yet reached. And now the environment is different. And so that has a waterfall effect. But when it comes to investing at the very early stages and you're investing in new companies that haven't raised a lot of capital, that haven't made those promises to their investors yet, now is an incredible time to do that,
right?
Because they have a clean slate and they don't have that baggage dragging them back. So it actually creates an opportunity for new businesses to disrupt incumbents in a way that might have been harder when capital was a moat.
All right. Well, great to check in with you. Allison Baumgate, she is general partner at Semper Virens, joining us via Zoom from San Francisco.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. Keep driving, stay
in prison. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. Check this out, Mike. We're seeing some buying here in the last 18 minutes of trading on the equity side. Mind you, we're still well off our best levels of the session, but, you know, we're up about 0.25% on the NASDAQ.
Yeah, S&P about flat, 39.85. You know, someone's buying the dip, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see. But a few more minutes left in the trade on day two of Jay Powell testimony. Some strong labor reports as well. So let's get to it. Let's get to our Drive to the Close guest. Sonia Meskin is head of U.S. Macro at BNY Mellon Investment Management, former senior financial expert at the IMF, also spent some 6 years at the New York Fed working on analytics. Perfect guest to have us on this Fed Wednesday and also on International Women's Day. She joins us via Zoom in New York City. Sonia, so good to have you here with us. We are living in interesting times, stuff coming at us. How do you make sense of the macro conditions of this market environment?
Yeah, you know, it's indeed very, very interesting times. I think we'd anticipated markets to be volatile this year. That is exactly what has transpired so far. I think there's certainly tension in the macro data between the, you know, the Fed tightening, but also the underlying strength of the U.S. economy, especially the U.S. consumer, as inflation remains elevated, of course, but also does continue to decline. We think real incomes will actually be fairly solid this year, barring massive layoffs and a recession. So certainly very, very interesting times. I think the outlook for risk assets for me is quite uncertain.
All right, wait, hang on a second, because you said you expected volatility, we're getting it. I've got a VIX that's below 20. What's up with that?
You know, I do think that there is certainly some optimism regarding the equity market. I think that investors are now pricing in on to some extent a more hawkish Fed. But on the other hand, the U.S. economic resilience indicates that we might be able to withstand that.
You know, Sonia, it seems like almost every day we see news about more big layoffs from the tech industry or even Wall Street. Yet I look at these job numbers that keep coming in today, the ADP employment number, 242,000 jobs added in February, way higher than expected. That jolts job openings at 10.8 million. What explains this sort of disconnect between the anecdotal headlines about layoffs and how this labor market just continues to be so red hot, according to the official numbers?
Of course. I think there is some sectoral rotation going on in the U.S. economy as well. We saw the tech companies do very, very well during the pandemic because mobility was low, but people still had money to spend. Certainly, those sectors hired quite, you know, strongly. There was definitely a run-up in crypto as well, for example. Those trends tend to you know, not last permanently, and they're currently unwinding. But those are very specific sectors, and we really haven't seen this, the layoffs spread to the rest of the economy. And what we're hearing instead from most sectors is that workers remain hard to source, and that even if we do enter a recession, that labor hoarding is a real risk.
So are you expecting another very strong jobs report on Friday? And, you know, is that just another good news is bad news type of situation for equity markets?
I think that, you know, there was definitely some seasonality that boosted the numbers in January. But I do think the labor market is, in fact, quite strong. So I think we will see maybe not as high of a headline number on Friday, but we'll see a strong number.
You know, it's interesting too. And folks much smarter than me, and I am thinking about our Neil Dutta of Renaissance Macro sending out a note. And he's like, remarkable that home building stocks are holding up. You had mortgage rates increasing for a fourth week, the highest level since mid-November, mortgage bankers putting that out. And yet I'm looking at the group of home builder stocks up 1.6%. So we know the Fed's going to continue raising rates. We're talking about maybe the possibility, good chance that we're going to have a recession. So again, how am I supposed to, as an investor, read that signal, Sonia?
Well, I think the housing market is a very interesting market. There is certainly, you know, in the pass-through of monetary policy to the real economy, the real estate sector, specifically residential real estate, is one of those key sectors that gets, you know, feels the monetary policy tightening. But that is a cyclical issue, and it always falls against the structural background of what's going on in that sector. And what we're facing today is almost the opposite of what we were facing in 2008. 2007, 2008, when, you know, rates, you know, obviously the Fed had been in a tightening cycle, but we really had excess capacity in the sector. We had the froth that this time around we had in crypto, but then we had it in the housing sector in the US, which was obviously for the rest of the economy much more pervasive. So this time around, we're having a structural shortage. We hadn't been building nearly as much as what, you know, demand would be consistent with.
So it's just supply demand, once again, out of balance in home building. And it's
exactly. And, you know, what actually ends up happening is that when those mortgage rates get high, we still, you know, sellers might not be as interested in selling at somewhat lower prices. But if you look at the run up in prices we've had since COVID, we've barely put a dent in that.
You know, Sonia, everyone I talk to seems to say the same thing, and that is when the Fed hikes rates aggressively, they tend to break something. And I'm wondering, it doesn't seem like anything's broken yet. Maybe, you know, market returns last year, but from the pure economic, you know, inputs, is anything breaking, or where, what would you look to sort of break first?
I just got about 30 seconds.
Of course. Well, I think that crypto is one area, and we're certainly seeing
that's
something
certainly
breaking
broken
there. You know, I would look at the private credit area. I do think things are fairly solid there overall. I think firms generally have turned out funding. But, you know, the longer we stay in the high rate environment and the sooner we get towards a point where firms have to roll over debt, the more you're probably going to see some difficulty rolling over into the higher rate environment.
Well, it makes your job and our job really interesting, all of this stuff that's going on. Sonia, thank you so much. So appreciate it. Sonia Meskin, she's head of U.S. Macro at BNY Mellon Investment Management, joining us via Zoom in New York City.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.